John Geiger is the author of Nothing is True, Everything is Permitted, The Life of Brian Gysin. Brian Gysin was a multimedia artist, poet, and novelist. His ideas influenced generations of artists and musicians, including David Bowie, Keith Haring, and Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones. Gysin's ideas probably had their strongest influence on the writer William S. Burroughs, but Burroughs once said there was something dangerous about what Gysin was doing. John Geiger told Ann Strangchamps that Brian Gysin's various creative pursuits are why he's not better known today.
He was everything and he was nothing. You know, he was a visual artist who didn't pursue that enough. He didn't get the right shows. He was a writer who was largely unpublished or had difficulty getting published. So he worked in all these different areas at a time when really artists were not writers and writers were not artists and poets were not painters. You know, there were these very clear delineations, and Gysin transcended all those. He could not be categorized. That was just, I think, the nature of his personality. But yeah, I mean, his interest in altered states is something that had touched him in his childhood. He had experimented with magic mushrooms by the time he was, you know, an early teenager, and had become very interested even then in these sort of different worlds, you know, that existed. Consequently, he became very attached later when in Paris at the Beat Hotel to the, you know, early period of drug experimentation. And
some great stories. Wasn't he getting shipments of psilocybin mushrooms and LSD from Timothy Leary?
Yes, he was. I mean, he was, in fact, intercepting shipments intended for Burroughs and ingesting them. I mean, he tried everything, you know, LSD and marijuana and hash. And he's the one who gave Alice B. Toklas her hash brownies recipe. You know, he was really on the forefront of that whole
Alice B. Toklas, Gertrude Stein's companion, who wrote the cookbook, and it became sort of an underground cult classic because it had a recipe for hashish brownies in it.
That's right. I mean, the cookbook has actually never gone out of print, and it became famous because of the inclusion, unbeknownst to Toklas, of a recipe that involved hashish.
Toklas didn't know it was in the book?
No, she had no, I mean, she knew that the recipe was in the book. She had no idea what the special ingredient in the recipe was. And she was initially horrified because the United States government had originally banned the cookbook. At least the recipe was withdrawn from the initial U.S. edition. But then it became news. This became newsworthy that this recipe was in the book, and subsequently it really, of course, helped sales. It was widely publicized, and she at first was horrified at the suggestion that she was peddling drugs in the book, but then came to see this as a great advantage in terms of the sales of the book.
One of the things I think is so interesting about Gysin is how much he linked the experimentation with drugs and altered states of consciousness to the making of art and to creativity itself. I mean, for instance, right around the same time, he was kind of trying to come up with ways of making art that were non-rational, kind of more mystical, I suppose you could say. Tell me something about the cut-ups, because that was his big innovation.
Yes, I mean, he took this idea that had really been floating around from his youth. You know, when he was in late teens, early 20s, he was in Paris. The surrealists were really ascendant, and he picked up this idea that you could use words almost like a painter uses paints, you know, that didn't have to follow a logical sort of structural sequence, that you could take them and sort of cut them up, randomly cut through pages, and then reassemble words or parts of sentences. And if you would sift through these, you would be able to find sort of new meanings. It really, the idea of the novel as something that sort of follows this logical narrative flow is not accurate to life. Life is constantly, in life, we are constantly being interrupted by random occurrences. There may be suddenly a cat jump out in front of us, or a horn beeping, or somebody bumping into us. And, you know, life is filled with those sorts of incidents, and they obviously affect the course of one's life. And novels had always followed this very lucid, rational, careful, methodical structure. And so here was a way that you could introduce a random element into writing. You could simply take texts, you could cut them up, and then you could reassemble words or sentences and suddenly create new meanings. Suddenly the course of what you're working on would take a radical turn, an unexpected turn. And so this idea, which really came out of surrealism, was something Gysin introduced at the Beat Hotel. And he had been cutting through some mat boards for his art and had newspapers below, and he realized that he was actually slicing through the words and the sentences. And Burroughs had been out, and when Burroughs came back that day, he showed him, you know, he constructed sentences, and suddenly there were some really interesting ideas, or you know, words were juxtaposed in ways. In fact, the title, The Ticket That Exploded, comes from a cut-up, you know, Nova Express, all these sorts of things, The Soft Machine. Suddenly, you could create new meaning out of seemingly random meaning.
Well, and then he expanded that some, didn't he? He created some early sound poems. Tell me something
yes.
about I Am That I Am.
Well,
where did that come from?
I mean, this is one of the permutations, this idea that you just take a simple phrase and by how you present it or by your reading of it, it has a host of different possible meanings. I am that I am. I am that I am. I mean, when he presented it, each reading of it would be radically different just by the way that he would present the text.
Am that I? I am. Am that? I am. Am that? Am I? I? Am that? I am. I am. That 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 I am.
So, you know, permutations did grow out of cut-ups, although it's a different thing.
It's funny because you can sort of see in each of his ideas things that other people took and ran with and went much further with. It's almost as though he just seeded the art world with these ideas and then left them for other people to develop.
You know, he was so different from Burroughs in that respect. He had wonderful ideas, and he had so many ideas that he threw them off, you know, almost randomly to people, and he would give them away as gifts to strangers. And yet, had he pursued, for example, cut-ups, and had he used it really thoroughly in his own writing, he might be a lot better known and a lot more influential in terms of a broader public. But for him, it was the half of the joy, I think, was just giving off these ideas, finding the right people for the right idea. And certainly, I mean, Burroughs was it for the cut-up.
He also seems to have been ahead of his time in trying to apply or sort of bring art and science together. I'm thinking about his obsession with this thing he created called the Dream Machine.
Well, in 1958, Geisen was traveling in the south of France on a bus. He was going to visit some friends over the holidays, and he was sleeping or, you know, in that half sleep that one has when you travel. And the light was coming just at the right angle through the trees, and the bus was traveling at the right speed for him to suddenly be transported into an altered state that was caused by flicker, the flashing light hitting his eyes and his brain at a specified interval. And this caused him to have an experience not unlike a drug experience. He was seeing colors and patterns and visions of things. He was transported out of his body and out of time. And, you know, at the end of this, when the bus came out of the trees and the whole experience ended abruptly, he wanted to know what had happened to him, obviously. And the person he turned to was Burroughs. And Burroughs had already been reading a book called The Living Brain by W. Gray Walter, a really interesting neurologist who had been doing research into flicker. So when Geisen discovered that you could actually create a visionary experience solely using light, in particular light between 8 and 13 flashes per second, which would stimulate the brain's alpha rhythms, then he sort of dropped everything he was working on and began to pursue a device that he called the Dream Machine. And it would be something that he thought would replace a television set in every suburban living room. It would be a way that people could, they could instead of watching a pre-programmed, you know, television, they could create their own programming and their own inner programming.
This would be a suburb populated by beatniks.
That was his hope, I think. And he later conspiratorially thought that that was the reason why the Dream Machine was never sort of widely disseminated. He felt that the institutional powers of control basically didn't want to see average people taking control of their brains in this way.
Tripping out in their living rooms. How did Brian Geisen's life end? I mean, he never achieved the success that so many of his friends did. He never became a kind of household word, but he was, at the same time, a hugely influential person. How did his life end?
His life, I'm sorry to say, ended badly. He had just a series of terrible medical problems. He had a colostomy. He later had lung cancer. He had emphysema. He was largely destitute. He was living in Paris at the end of his life. And, you know, the last years were spent trying to get his papers in order and just complete something. He had so many ideas, and he had so much on the go that he never seemed to succeed in finishing much of anything. So he did finish his second novel. He did complete a masterpiece, visual work called A Calligraffiti of Fire, a very large painting over many panels using the calligraphic abstraction style that he had started using in the 50s. And I mean, he was just really organizing his affairs. I think he felt disappointed. I think he felt neglected. And it wasn't a very happy end to his life, sadly.
Hmm. If he were alive today, what do you think he would make of the direction our art world, our culture has moved in? Would he see that some of his own interests and ideas have kind of gone mainstream, or would he think that we've really reacted and moved in the other direction, in a more conservative direction?
Well, interestingly, I think that, I mean, the art world has moved a lot closer to Brian Gysin's vision. You know, this whole idea of the multimedia art, you know, installations, these are things that he was doing in the, you know, in the 50s and early 60s. So, you know, he was really the grandfather of much of what we see in contemporary art today, and in terms of literature as well, I think. So I think he would probably feel that he had had an impact, you know, that even though he hadn't profited from this, that others had, and that generally our culture had. But again, it was even at the end of his life, it was a constant sort of sorrow that he had. We mentioned Alice B. Toklas's cookbook, and the first time anyone presented or published a hash brownie recipe, well, that was turned into a major Hollywood motion picture called I Love You, Alice B. Toklas, with Peter Sellers. And there was no mention or reference to the fact that, of course, this was his recipe, not Alice B. Toklas's recipe. So you know, Burroughs was the one who used the cut-up and became famous really on the strength of the cut-up, or certainly that advanced Burroughs' reputation in his literary career. And Gysin got very little, I mean, in spite of William Burroughs' best efforts to always deflect attention and credit to Gysin, at the end of the day, it became known as William Burroughs' cut-up method. Even with the Dream Machine, I mean, it was really Gysin who was the link, the missing link between the scientists who were doing research, neurological research, and beginning to quantify the effects of strobe on the human brain. And then, of course, today we have, you know, raves and discos where strobe's really integral to the experience. Well, Gysin is the missing link between the two. He's the one who introduced the idea that flashing light can alter your brain into the whole cultural realm. So he had all these influences, and yet he's received not a lot of credit for them.
John Geiger is the author of Nothing is True, Everything is Permitted, The Life of Brian Gysin. Geiger spoke with Anne Strangechamps.